This is Pure Decking for Thursday, November 30th, I think. Yeah, November 30th, whatever the year is. I don't really care. This show about stuff that interests me, like information security, pointing out how rigged the game is, and drinking heavily so the pain stops. I'm Morps, and tonight we have Syntax. Syntax, what are you drinking?
I have what's left of a Newcastle and then some Kentucky Breakfast Stout.
Good man. Cyberlord, what are you drinking?
Got a red blend that I now get for free.
Oh.
Nice too.
Well, free booze is always good booze. And Madman, what are you drinking to make the pain stop?
Bunnenkugel's Snowdrift Vanilla Porter.
And I am about halfway through a Dragon's Milk pint. So, always good. Anyways, let's see. First article is actually from, as long as it's not like, you know, somebody throwing out the Milwaukee's Best or, you know, anything that says light in the name.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with Natty Light.
We can get some Pabst Blue Ribbon and go full-blown fucking hipster.
I was just thinking, don't ask, was saying free booze equals best booze. It's like, well, usually except...
Well, yeah, so, but I mean, you know, when $1.75 gets you a 40, it's almost free.
Depends on what's in that 40.
Well, OE or, you know, Natty Light.
You can be like Budweiser and supplement the beer with the rice just to get the alcohol up.
I mean, yeah. Mickey's. Oh, Mickey's High School.
Yep. So, let's see. The first article, the one I thought would be kind of fun to talk about, is from The Register. If tech industry wants another wave of innovation to match the PC or the internet, Google and Facebook must be broken up. Journalist and film producer Jonathan Taplin told an audience at the University College London facilities, or Faculty of Law this week. He was speaking at an event titled Crisis in Copyright Policy, How the Digital Monopolies Have Cornered Culture and What It Means for Us All, where he credited the clampers put on the Bell and then IBM for helping us to create the PC industry and the internet. So he's talking about when they broke up IBM, or not IBM, when they broke up Ma Bell, made all the baby bills, broke up the telephone company. And IBM, I don't think they ever broke it up, but they threatened to a couple of times. So IBM gave a lot of their IP away. You know, that's where you got the IBM compatible PC, just to avoid being a monopoly. The director emeritus of the Annenberg Innovation Lab at the University of Southern California also wrote the book Move Fast and Break Things, a surprise bestseller. Plenty of the Internet is Awful books have come and gone over the past decade, but Taplin's experience captured the post-Trump mood, which has turned strongly against Silicon Valley's Internet giant platforms this year. Taplin's experience is the difference. It's vast and varied. Over the years, he's been Bob Dylan's manager, produced the movies Mean Street and The Last Waltz, and in 1997 launched the first ever VOD startup, Entertainer, from which he knows a bit about antitrust. When Sony, one of his VOD company shareholders, teamed up with Hollywood studios Warner and Universal to launch a copycat service called MovieLink, Taplin filed an antitrust lawsuit. Defendants conspired and combined to fix prices, organized a group boycott of Entertainer, reneged on their licensing agreements with Entertainer, and otherwise tried and continue to try to destroy Entertainer's viability, it alleged. Entertainer closed down. 4 years later, Taplin reached a financial settlement. He'd already annoyed the movie industry by testifying against DRM laws, but ensured he would never work in Hollywood again. He then sued and settled with Apple, Google, and Napster over patent infringement. Taplin told his audience that he'd been moved by the fate of his friend Levon Helm, the band's drummer, who was forced to go back on the road in his 60s after radiation therapy for cancer. Helm died broke. Today, Taplin points out, YouTube accounts for 57% of all songs streamed over the internet, but thanks to a loophole, returns just 13.5% of revenue. They actually wrote percent there, which kind of, it's like there's a little symbol on the keyboard for that, guys. It's okay. that's not a willing buyer-seller relationship, he said, referring to the UGC loophole that Google enjoys. Not when available to Spotify or Apple Music. But it isn't just songwriters and musicians who are poorly paid. The average person who works for over 2 hours a day for Mark Zuckerberg generating profile data. I misread that. So it isn't just songwriters and musicians who are poorly paid. The average person works over 2 hours a day for Zuckerberg generating profile data. Okay, I see what he's saying there. Taplin pointed out that Bell held patents on many technologies, including the transistor. Wait a minute. Bell held a patent on the frickin' transistor?
That's cool.
I did not know that. The laser and the solar cell, and that it agreed to license royalty-free as part of the 1956 consent decree. As a consequence, 7,820 patents, or 1.3% of all unexpired U.S. patents in a wide range of fields, became freely available in 1956. Most of these patents cover technologies from Bell Laboratories, the research substitute of the Bell system, arguably the most innovative industry laboratory in the world at the time, academics estimate. Bell was forbidden from competing outside telecoms. Taplin saw history repeat with IBM. Under the 1956, again, consent decree, IBM was obliged to unbundle software from hardware in the 1960s, but the competition authorities again opened up an investigation in 1969, which ran over 13 years. Caution made IBM ensure its first microcomputer, the IBM PC, launched in 1981, was an open platform. IBM chose three operating systems to run on the first PC, but clearly flavored an outsider from tiny Seattle outfit originally called Micro-Soft. Then Microsoft got the treatment. So every 20 years we have this fight, and we're about to have it again, Taplin told the audience. He elaborated, antitrust was necessary not because they're too big, but because there's no market solution to Google and Facebook. The barriers to entry are now so high, nobody is going to bust open the ad duopoly. At this point, this is the point made by Oracle in its European complaint. Effective behavioral advertising requires hoods of data, and nobody can gather sufficient data enough to compete against Google's super profiles or Facebook's graph in advertising or behavioral advertising. Google enjoys market dominance in several markets with a billion-plus user base, including video, mobile operating systems, maps, email, web, analytics, as well as search, and adding Chrome, which has almost 60% of desktop and mobile. Taplin snided Snapchat is an example of a company that tried to innovate but refused to take Facebook's buyout offer. Facebook has simply copied its features. There may be interim solutions, Taplin said, or short of a breakup. Missouri has filed the first competition lawsuit against Google in 4 years. The Trump era is more hostile to corporate mega-mergers than previous Republican administrations. Remember that it was under Reagan that the IBM antitrust probe was killed in 1982, and under Bush, too, the Microsoft litigation was rapidly settled. The DOJ has filed suit to block AT&T and Time Warner from pairing up. Not everybody agreed with Taplin's remedy. There are revenue streams other than advertising. They maintain their monopoly so fiercely because they're happy being a big fish in a small pond, and they fight to keep the larger pond of transactions and bundles at bay. So, yeah. Anyways, the rest of the article is, you know, kind of poking at the argument a little bit, but not by much. So, I don't know. I don't like government interference, but monopoly is a real threat in a free market if you don't have a market answer to these guys.
I don't know that there isn't a market answer. The reason Standard Oil took the government to break it up is because Standard Oil every year lowered the price of kerosene. Every year they made it less likely to blow up your house. So the reason they had a monopoly is they were saving their customers money and making them less likely to die. That's not something that needs to be broken up.
Well, I mean, how do you compete with Google and Facebook's free? You can't go cheaper than free.
Then you go free and you offer something that they don't. Mm. Or if you can't, what's wrong with Google or Facebook existing?
I don't think there's anything wrong with them existing, but because they do control a large portion of the tech sector, it is very difficult for new startups to get funding because right now the business model on the internet is advertising-based. Very few other models work. You either do a subscription-based system, which you have things like Patreon, and so you have a lot of little things that you try, you know, if you want to try to, you know, support a comic or a music artist or something like that on Patreon, you end up having to do all these little nickel and dime subscriptions, which is a la carte, but you know, there's, it's also people on the internet, so your quality is all over the map. Or you have things like, you know, free with ads, or you have to pay some kind of a subscription model, which is what you normally see with enterprise applications. So it's very difficult to break into that consumer space right now, especially against, you know, how do you spin up another search engine against Google and have any kind of profitability? I'm pretty sure DuckDuckGo is operating at a loss every year, or at least not so much at a loss, but out of donations. So, and, you know, Facebook, Twitter's about to fall over dead. I think the only reason Twitter's still going is because some really famous people, like, say, the president, are still using it. So, and it's more simple than, it's more simple. English, it's simpler than Facebook. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't like the idea of government interference. I really don't. But I get the argument he's making.
You know who I think is going to keep Twitter alive? Wholly off subject.
Go ahead.
Is porn.
Don't they block porn?
No. Twitter is the only one that's like, nah, go ahead, post it. Like, we don't care. Nudity, whatever, go.
I am not following the right Twitter feeds.
You're not.
Like, Carlos Danger, dude. Look up Carlos Danger. You'll see penis.
Oh, yeah.
Like, okay. Madman is obviously following the wrong Twitter feeds as well.
Maybe that's what Madman likes. Don't yuck his yum.
Wondering how you didn't know when a senator was being blasted for 2 years for showing his dick on Twitter.
Well, yeah, I just assumed that the photo got taken down.
No, like, so 70%, okay, 50% of my Twitter is other InfoSec people. The other 50% is porn stars, because they're fucking interesting.
I may need to get active on Twitter again. I haven't used Twitter in a decade.
Oh, God, we're selling him Twitter. Don't.
And boobies.
You can get the boobs other ways, Morps.
I'm just now envisioning tweeting at Trump and seeing if we could get him to say something about decking. That would be hilarious.
Oh, God, yeah, that would be great. See, the plus with Twitter boobies is they're, like, random. They, like, pop up in your feed, and it's, like, this little bonus.
Like, oh, I was reading some economics, and now there's boobs. This just got exactly interesting again.
Because, you know, you're watching Donald Trump's, like, moronic, childish rants, and then you're like, oh, the world is horrible. And then you're like, oh, look, it's, you know, some whatever getting railed by whatever, because they do GIFs and, like, videos too, because of course they do. And you're like, oh, look, it's not so bad. Someone's getting laid. And then you keep scrolling and you're like, oh, no, the RSA's broken. Like, it's that little oasis in the sea of shit.
Go ahead, Cyber.
Has anyone here used Mastodon?
I've heard of it. I think I looked at it as a Digital Dojo link at one point. I thought about setting it up, but it's apparently fairly heavy.
Yep. It's not really a competitor for Twitter. I mean, even though Twitter's dying anyway.
Well, it's a decentralized open source version of Twitter where, like, you can have servers tied together and mm-hmm. Or I guess your Mastodon account can log into multiple servers to get different feeds, kind of thing. So, which, you know, as much as I hate email, that model of just having a service where you can stand up your own server and it uses DNS to find it, I would like to see that for some other things.
There was one for Facebook a while ago, and I was on it for about a year. And, the guy ended up dying. The guy who made it committed suicide or something.
Oh, geez. Identica, the Psychrosis thing, StatusNet and Identica also do it. So, but there's no, these are software projects. There's no company behind them.
Mm-hmm.
So that still is the question of, you know, do we enact monopoly against Facebook and Google or not?
So the problem with doing it against Google really is
they control so much of the infrastructure of the internet. I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you break them up.
Yeah, well, that and they have the way they have set their business model up. So yeah, they're making money from a couple of different places, and then they funnel it all into R&D in other places. And that's why they went to, in fact, so really the whole thing, like Google self broke themselves up because they're no longer Google. It's now Alphabet, which is kind of a holdings company.
Yeah, who the hell came up with that name? It's like, we want to give every conspiracy theory ever validation.
Oh, absolutely. I think they did it for the lulz. But really, I mean, that's the way they should have been doing it. Was like, oh, yeah, let's just do a holdings company. So then you're like, oh, I'm not a monopoly. I'm 47 different companies that are all primarily owned by one company. Because that's not a monopoly. That's just business.
True.
No, that holding companies can have antitrust brought against them, right?
I actually don't know. Because how can you be a monopoly in a in an industry that's just owning other things?
I mean, Cycross in the chat room is saying that could still be considered a trust. They could still take antitrust. Because that's true. They can bring antitrust against groups of companies. Like if you have duopolies.
Yeah.
So. I don't know. I'm like I said, I'm not keen on the idea of government interference in the market. And if you did break up Google, if you broke up Facebook, honestly, shit would happen. You'd have the same thing that happened with AT&T, where all the little spinoff companies would eventually die off and you'd consolidate back into Facebook again, just out of sheer momentum. You know, whoever ends up owning the website wins. But the Google breakup, now that one's interesting. Because I think if you did that, you would seriously damage how a lot of people use the internet. I mean, I wouldn't give a shit, but I know a lot of people would lose their minds.
Yeah, a Google breakup would be like, and honestly, Facebook, there's nothing to break up. They do a couple of things.
Well, yeah, that's where you'd end up with like the telecom breakup, where you're just like, well, okay, this version of this copy of Facebook can service these states, and this one can do these states, or oh dear God, we'll end up with the same bullshit we got in the insurance industry, where you're not allowed to compete across state lines.
Yeah,
that's not good.
But yeah, I mean, the whole reason why people use fucking Facebook is to communicate with people that they're not in the same physical space anymore.
I agree.
I don't know. That's
well, it really comes down to I don't like the idea, especially in this space, I don't like the idea of the government interfering, because it's not like those people know what the hell they're doing.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, breaking up Facebook would just be asinine, because it would be done stupid.
Well, I mean, they own a couple of other businesses, like they own Oculus.
Yeah.
And I think they bought a few other things.
But, yeah, they have several things, but it's.
I don't think any of them accomplishing anything.
Yeah, I don't think any of them actually make money on their own.
They're saying WhatsApp and Instagram in the chat room.
Oh yeah,
didn't they buy Tumblr too? Did they buy Tumblr?
Somebody bought Tumblr. Something for Google.
No, Google didn't buy Tumblr.
No, that's something I'm going to ask Google.
Oh. I'm going to say, Google bought Blogger.
Because that's the other place for all of the really weird porn.
Yeah. I think Twitter hasn't been bought out by anybody yet, and they haven't bought anybody either. Of course, they don't make money, so I don't know how
Yeah, I'm like, they're losing money hand over fist. Like,
I'm pretty sure their funding at this point is coming from the government, so... Like, no, this platform is way too useful. It's like, LinkedIn makes money. Otherwise, the CIA would be running LinkedIn, too. Like, no. When we're investigating people, that's where... Okay, I have it on word from an FBI agent I talk to on a regular basis. Yeah, they use LinkedIn when they need to look up who does what.
Oh, absolutely.
So, if you're doing something crazy illegal, make a fake LinkedIn profile.
Yeah, no,
I
mean,
shouldn't say that.
I've used.
Shouldn't be giving people hints.
I use LinkedIn for social engineering engagements all the time.
Oh yeah,
you can get an entire like corporate hierarchy structure from LinkedIn.
Not to mention email lists.
Yeah.
What'd you find out, Mad Ben?
I found out whenever I type in who owns Tumblr, it redirects me to a microbiology firm.
Okay, hold on. I got it.
Go to the Wikipedia page for Tumblr. Here we go. Micro blah, 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 blah. Owned by Oath, Inc. So who owns Oath, Inc.? Okay, Yahoo did buy it, and then they spun it off into Oath. Oh. Oath, Inc. is a subsidiary. Oh, no, I'm wrong. Oath is owned by Verizon. Verizon owns Tumblr.
Wow.
Verizon just through a holdings company named Oath.
Yeah, okay, cool. That's the best. Yeah, like I said, if you want to find weird porn, Tumblr's place for that one.
Well, as an expert in weird porn, I will take your word for it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So, all right, let's move on here. I think at this point we're just kind of waxing lyrical about weird porn.
Nothing wrong with that. I made a show out of that.
That's true, you did. You did do that.
I should do that again.
Yeah, you could. Let's see. Next article is from Engadget. Lenovo has only just settled a massive $3.5 million fine for pre-installing adware on laptops without users' consent, and now it seems HP is getting in on the stealth installation action, too. According to numerous reports gathered by Computer World, the brand is deploying a telemetry client on customer computers without asking permission. The software, first identified on November 15th, is called HP Touchpoint Analytics Service and appears to replace the self-managed HP Touchpoint Manager solution. According to the official productivity description, it features the tools you need to ensure your managed device's security and brings you greater peace of mind. I love it when they put bullshit like that in a... It's like, oh yes, this tool makes you happier. No, it doesn't. It shows ads. The problem is that it's installing itself without permission and is wreaking havoc on customer systems. One complaint on the HP support site said, "It has been making my computer work so hard I can hear it cranking away and the light in the back of my computer is flashing rapidly in tune with the cranking. So he's hearing his fans and the hard drive spin up. In Task Manager, I can see it starting and stopping numerous applications. Not yet clear how the new driver is being installed. It may have come with the latest Windows updates or via HP and its support assistant process. But regardless, customers aren't happy." This is why you have to blow away a new machine and get all the shitware off of it. But regardless, customers aren't happy. I understand that it hoovers up all sorts of telemetry data, and I'm not willing to share too much of it, really, despite definitely not without my knowledge, says one user of HP's forums. The offending driver can be removed relatively quickly and easily, but against the wider backdrop of repeated privacy scandals, that's hardly the point. There's no sign of official response or even acknowledgement from HP on the matter, but they can be sure their customers will take action, will take them to the task over. We reached out to the company for a comment, and the comment they got back was, "HP Touchpoint Analytics is a service we have offered since 2014 as part of the HP Support Assistant. It anonymously collects diagnostic information about hardware performance. No data is shared with HP unless access is expressly granted." Yeah, we know how that goes. Customers can opt out or uninstall the service at any time. I love opt out. I love opt out. It's like, yeah, we're going to bend you over. We're going to fuck you up the ass. We're going to light your house on fire, and we're going to strangle your dog. Unless you remember to opt out. I mean, it's just like...
Or like in the middle of us doing this, you're like, no, stop, please. It's like, are you sure?
I'm sorry, sir. You have to opt out before we rape the dog.
Yeah.
I thought
of that earlier.
Yeah.
The Checker's Guide to the Galaxy.
HP Touchpoint Analytics was recently updated, and there are no changes to privacy settings as part of this update. We take customer privacy very seriously and enact in accordance with the strict policy available, and they get a link to the policy. I call bullshit. I don't think... Actually, you know what it probably is? It's probably not so much that it's doing anything new. It's probably just so poorly written that it's just blowing up machines.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The Touchpoint Analytics and their... that other thing. What do they call it? The other thing.
Yeah.
Is... It's horrible. It really is just like a hodgepodge kind of thrown together. Like, yeah, we'll do this thing. It's cool.
They'll make a GUI in Visual Basic to track the killer's IP address, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm pretty sure that's the same programmers they used. So, anyways.
Time to kill the video game you're playing. We need to do an update.
Well, that's just Microsoft at this point.
Yeah.
So let's see. Next article is from Motherboard, the Vice News, and is kind of interesting. On Tuesday, a California federal court ordered the popular cryptocurrency exchange and wallet service Coinbase to turn over records on thousands of customers to the Internal Revenue Service. The requested records include the name, birthday, address, and account activity for any user who bought, sold, sent, or received more than $20,000 worth of Bitcoin in their accounts between 2013 and 2015. The order marks the end of a year-long court battle between the IRS and Coinbase that began last November when the IRS sought user records for all Coinbase customers. After meeting resistance from Coinbase and Coinbase customers who argued that the order was overly broad, the IRS narrowed the scope of its request to only Coinbase customers who had trafficked in more than $20,000 worth of cryptocurrency in the specified time period. According to the internal Coinbase audit from July, of the 14,000 affected users, 6,200 had bought, sold, sent, or received less than $60,000 between 2013 and 2015. Based on internal Coinbase audit. This arguably makes them rather small fish. In January, Coinbase CEO Brian Armstrong wrote in a Medium post asking for detailed transaction information on so many people simply for using digital currency is a violation of customers' privacy and is not the best way for us to accomplish our mutual objective. U.S. citizens are supposed to pay capital gains tax on cryptocurrency transactions, and the IRS labels virtual currencies as properties for federal tax purposes. As the court order shows, more than 10,000 people bought or sold more than $20,000 worth of cryptocurrency, but only 800 to 900 taxpayers a year. 800 to 900 taxpayers a year have electronically filed returns with property described or description related to Bitcoin from 2013 to 2015. It's like less than 1,000 people in the United States have admitted to owning Bitcoin to the IRS.
Well, yeah, because when you file it as investments because it's tax different.
Yeah.
It's because the people that are going, I got Bitcoin, are fucking dumb and they need to stop.
In short, the court order's reaction by the IRS to possible tax avoidance on cryptocurrency gains, especially this year. Holy shit, Bitcoin like tripled in value. Arguably, though, the tax law simply hasn't caught up with cryptocurrency, and the order effectively places over 14,000 Coinbase users, or 1,400 Coinbase users, no, 14,000, I read it right the first time, under investigation simply for using a new technology. U.S. legislators introduced a bill in September that would exempt any cryptocurrency transaction under $600 from taxation. Well, that's nice of them. Like, yeah, you can do little things with it, but, you know, move any significant amount of money, and we have to know about it. Of course, I guess that's normal for a... income-based tax system, isn't it?
Yep.
Motherboard.
But
has
I
want
to move to a sales tax.
Yeah, Motherboard has reached out for a comment and has yet to get anything. So, yeah, they're gonna start tracking Bitcoin like any other commodity, so that they can tax it. I figured that was what was gonna happen. Everybody was like, "Oh, they're gonna outlaw Bitcoin." No, they're not. They're gonna tax the shit out of it. Is what they're gonna do.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
So. Anybody else, any thoughts?
It's being considered as property.
Yep.
That's slightly better than income.
Yeah, it's capital gains.
Yeah.
Dicros, Coinbase deals in Ethereum. But you're right. You were spot on a couple of weeks ago when you told me to move everything into Ethereum, by the way. Because it's like, damn, that one shot up too. So, but great.
Did you break it?
No, I got an email telling me my PTO tomorrow was canceled.
Nah.
Oh, that sucks.
It's like, yeah, we need you to go to this meeting. Nobody else understands this shit. Son of a bitch. Somebody talk about the Mac thing while I write an email real quick.
Mac is broken.
Have a Mac thing posted?
Yeah, post the thing. Or are we just...
There, link thing, Mac thing.
Yeah!
Root, no password.
Yeah. Shit, now I gotta find my mouse.
I can read.
Okay, someone else read.
Apple releases macOS High Sierra security fix for critical root vulnerability. If you're running macOS High Sierra, it's time to update your Mac as soon as possible. Apple has released a security update that addresses the security vulnerability discovered yesterday afternoon. The update is now available through the Mac App Store. Apple details the fix here. Security update 2017-001. Directory utility available for macOS. Yeah. Impact. An attacker may be able to bypass administrator authentication without supplying the administrator's password. Description. A logic error existed in the validation of credentials. This was addressed with improved credential validation. When you install Security Update 2017-001 on your Mac, the build number of macOS will be 17B1002. So forth, if you require the root user account on your Mac, you can enable the root user and change the root user's password. While the security vulnerability was a rather serious one, Apple has promptly responded with a fix less than 24 hours after it became public. The issue did not affect older versions of macOS, although there doesn't appear to be a fix available for macOS 10.13.2 beta yet, as the fix downloadable here only appears to apply to macOS 10.13.1 for now. Apple issued this statement 925 Mac following the software fix. Security is a top priority for every Apple product, and regrettably, we stumbled with this release of macOS. When our security engineers became aware of the issue Tuesday afternoon, we immediately began working on an update that closes the security hole. This morning, as of 8 a.m., the update is available for download, and starting today, later today, it will be automatically installed on all systems running the latest version of macOS High Sierra. We greatly regret this error, and we apologize to all Mac users for both releasing this vulnerability and for the concern it has caused. Our customers deserve better. We are auditing our development process to help prevent this from happening again.
Okay, you're good.
Okay, I just realized something.
Yeah, go ahead.
The security update is 2017-001.
First
which
one they
means
put out.
This is the only security update that they've put out this year.
Yeah, Apple doesn't admit when they have security vulnerabilities.
Ridiculous fucking.
I think they had to admit this one.
Yeah, you could log into root with no fucking password. They kind of couldn't deny that.
Yeah,
it was like a. I remember back when there was that bash vulnerability. Oh, Mac's come installed with.
Did we lose him?
Maybe.
Called Bash. I heard that on local news somewhere.
Oh, Bash. Oh, Apple, you daffy bastard.
So, yeah.
This is, I mean, honestly, this is why you don't use. I mean, just the condescending nature of Apple's press release makes me want to stab every single Mac user.
So, and before anybody's wondering, yes, at work I grabbed one of our test MacBooks, and it absolutely works. You could log in, no password needed, and once you activated that root account, it was activated. The actual vulnerability was they had a weird bug in the LDAP server that Mac runs on a local machine. I don't know why it runs an LDAP server. I don't know what was wrong with Pam.
Because LDAP's awesome, and there's never, ever, ever been a single problem with it, ever.
So Open Directory D would see that a root account existed because it's a Unix-based distro. There has to be one. It was just deactivated and activated. And a deactivated account, but it doesn't have a password. There was never a password set. So the password was blank, but the account wasn't supposed to be usable, at least not directly. And Open Directory D would activate the account. It would fix the glitch and let you log in as root. So you'd fail the first time, and then it would just work the second time. Literally, all you had to do is press enter twice. It's just absolutely stupid. And what they left out of that press release is apparently it breaks file sharing. The security fix like messes up file sharing on random Macs. They've already put out a fix for that too, but it's just like you have to go to their website and click the little fix-it link or whatever it is. So... It's
yeah, but
like,
that's not a security update, even though a security update broke it.
Yeah, it's just kind of like, come on, guys, really? So, anyway.
It doesn't come with viruses, it just has Mac OS.
So the whole Mac thing is really fun because there's, I don't know if you guys know this or not, but in InfoSec, there are two camps. There's definitely a Linux and Mac camp. So there's a lot of guys that are like, no, Macs, they're fine, whatever, ship it, like, just do it. Excuse me. Oh, and there's guys who use Windows, too. Like, but, yeah, all of the Mac guys, just like everywhere else, if you own a Mac, they're really fucking... Like, oh, this is the best. You have to use a Mac. Macs are amazing.
A Mac is a BSD-based system with a nicer GUI than a lot of the stock Linux desktops. That's it.
Yeah.
Better, a little bit better support when it comes to some of the software. But, okay. Personally, my philosophy on these damned religious fights, an operating system is a tool. You pick the correct tool for the job. And it's a little bit more complex of a tool than a hammer, but there are, in fact, multiple kinds of hammers, so you pick the right one for the job and the one you know how to use. So, you know what? If Mac works great for you, fantastic. Good for you. It doesn't do that much for me, so I don't actually care.
For a while, my job was trying to get me to use OS X. I used it for a good year and a half before I just said fuck it and installed the Linux on it.
I did the same thing at a previous job. They gave me a very nice Mac Pro, the one with the dual Xeons, and the old school big ass aluminum chassis. You know, before they switched to the trash can model. It's a really nice machine. Ran really, really good when I was triple booting it for whatever VM or whatever OS I needed. But I mean, it's like OS X is fine. I didn't have any major problem using it. I just didn't. It certainly didn't change my life. I mean, it's, you know, like some people, it's like the moment they see that, it's like, oh my God, yes. So I don't know. I guess it's just like anything, you know, whatever works for you, right? So I just my really big bugaboo about Macs is they cost about twice what they should. So,
at least twice what they should, yeah.
You know, and say, hey, whatever. But, you know, I did the Hackintosh thing for a little while, too. It's more just the challenge of doing it than anything.
Yeah.
So, has no real bearing on whether or not I actually, like, think it's a better operating system or not. I actually don't. I do believe that Linux is probably the best operating system out there today. It just doesn't have all the software support, so... You know, I have a lot of Windows machines, and I have a lot of Linux machines, and, you know, I've had some Mac stuff floating around. I actually don't currently have a functional Mac. I've got a couple of Macs in pieces over there, but they're not doing anything because I need to put a new processor in one of them, and they're kind of too old at this point to be very useful.
That's what happens when you try and fix things with a hammer.
Okay, it was not a hammer. It was the wall, and I may have thrown the Mac at it, but that's not the point.
But fixing it with a brick.
Inner wall, interior wall, 2x4.
Oh, okay.
Well, I think it was a 2x4. Anyways, you know, whatever the particular frame is made out of. But, yeah, so I've got a processor to stick in that Mac Mini to make it work again, but because Apple likes to say, oh, no, I'm sorry, that computer is 4 years old. You'll have to buy a new one. So, you know, I can't even run the modern operating, you know, modern version of OS X on it, so even if I do fix it, I'm going to be loading Linux on it. Because it's like, I can put a modern Linux on there, or I could put a 4-year-old OS X on it. Which one do you think I'm doing?
Which one will let you use modern software, or just not brick your shit because it won't update your crap?
Well, we're going to go with the one that doesn't brick my shit. It's like, yeah. If I really need to run OS X, I'll run it in a VM.
Yeah, the whole Apple forced obsolescence is another reason why I'm like, no, fuck you guys.
Yeah. So, next up is from Crypto Coin News. The $6.831 trillion stock market, NASDAQ, the world's second largest stock exchange behind the New York Stock Exchange, will enable Bitcoin futures trading by mid-2018.
Awesome.
A Wall Street Journal report revealed that NASDAQ and Cantor Fitzgerald and Company will list Bitcoin futures within the first half of 2018. The two financial institutions are rushing the integration of Bitcoin, given the cryptocurrency's recent surge in pricing, where it hit $11,441. I think it's back down to $9,600-ish. Give me a second, I'll just check.
There are going to be some analysts blowing their fucking brains out trying to map Bitcoin.
Considering how the history that thing has. Yeah, here we go. Bitcoin is currently at $9,679.97. Ethereum is currently sitting at $430.79. And Litecoin is at $84.76. And I, of course, was using Coinbase. If anybody's curious. So that's where I was pulling that from. Let's see. According to sources familiar with NASDAQ's plan for a Bitcoin futures exchange launch, NASDAQ's Bitcoin futures and contracts will be listed on the NASDAQ futures. Through that, investors in traditional finance sector and stock brokerages will be able to engage in Bitcoin trading. An investor with Wall Street Journal Cantor, a major U.S.-based financial firm, also revealed that intends to launch Bitcoin futures and derivatives in its own flagship exchange. Sean Matthews, chief executive of Cantor Fitzgerald & Company, stated that cryptocurrencies are a new asset class that is not going away and that Bitcoin is here to stay. He stated, the asset class is not going away. If you look at the next level, it will be institutions coming in and being larger participants in the marketplace, especially as liquidity gets better. Cantor's futures exchanges have already been approved by the U.S. Commodities and Futures Trading Commissions, and considering that the CFTC has approved several Bitcoin futures listings, including the Bitcoin options, derivatives, and futures exchanges of Ledger X, regulatory hurdles of Cantor and listing Bitcoin are expected to be minimal. Yeah, like we said, they're not going to outlaw Bitcoin. They're just going to tax it.
Yep.
Cycros is saying cryptocurrency is here to stay, but Bitcoin's days are numbered. He might be right, but Bitcoin's got a hell of a lot of momentum behind it right now. So I don't know.
Yeah,
because that's the name nobody ever, or the name everybody knows is Bitcoin. So it might. We'll see.
Yeah,
might be
I don't
VHS
see...
versus 8-track thing again, or not VHS 8-track, VHS versus Betamax thing again, where
yeah.
The technically better one still doesn't win.
Yeah, and that's what I see. Because there's far too many people that are dumb, and that aren't going to do any research, that just don't care to do any research, and they're going to be like, oh, I'm going to do this Bitcoin thing, because they think that that's all it is. Like, there's going to be people that buy Bitcoin and are really mad that they don't actually get coins with the fucking B on it sent to their house.
That's probably true. Well, these, I mean, they're talking about listing it on NASDAQ, so, I mean, it'll at least be commodities brokers who are used to only owning things on paper.
That's true.
Although, you're right. I mean, I've actually been playing around with Magi Coin a bit lately because you can still mine that one on CPUs. Yeah. And I've actually made $6 in the past couple of weeks playing around with that one. I don't know that that's a fantastic return on investment, but, you know, the fact that I've made any money at all with it's kind of cool.
I mean, you probably used more electricity than $6 worth.
Yeah, considering it's using an extra CPU on my server, that's probably true. But it is a server that would be on all the time anyways, doing other things. I'm just throwing cores that aren't doing anything else at it right now. So I'll probably have to shut it down when I start playing around with the community edition of QRadar. So, but... Oh, for anybody who doesn't know, IBM put out a community version of QRadar. I don't think it can handle a lot of flows per minute, but if you want to play around with that software, it's actually a pretty badass sim. So, and it'll run Python and I forget what the web framework they were using is. It's one of the common Python web frameworks, but Raspberry with solar panels.
I've actually seen someone who is mining Bitcoin with a cluster of Raspberry Pis.
Oh, I believe it. I'd absolutely believe it. I did it. I mined $30 worth of Bitcoin 5 years ago using those little USB ASICs
and
Raspberry Pi 2.
Nice.
That was set up in the dining room behind a bookcase and ran for about 4 months, and I eventually moved that stuff into EOBot.
Because
okay. That made a hell of a lot more sense than, you know, this little noisy thing running behind the bookcase.
Yeah, I watched some guys at DEF CON mining DEF Coin using something very similar.
Yeah, Cypress, I only made about $300 with it, actually. Because I pulled some of the cash out and played around with it, other things. So, grand total, I have probably made about $300 on Bitcoin.
Nice.
So, what'd you ask, Madman? I'm sorry.
Like, does Dogecoin still exist, or is that
absolutely? Died? It still exists, and it's still basically worthless.
Yeah.
So, when I say worthless, it has a currency store. It's like 0.002 cents per coin. So you can absolutely mine Dogecoin and then turn it into something that's actually worth something. It's just, it's like the peso in the 90s. It's just not worth anything.
Yeah.
So
it's going to be like the US dollar in a decade.
But, so anyways, my point is, if they're going to start listing Bitcoin futures on the commodity exchanges starting next year, you might want to grab $100 or so and go ahead and put it in Bitcoin. I mean, just, you know, play money. Don't put anything you can't afford to lose in it. But if they're going to start trading futures of it, the value of it's going to skyrocket just from people trading it on exchanges. And I don't mean, you know, the internet exchanges. I mean, like, you know, the well-known financial ones, because you're going to start seeing the big financier companies getting involved.
Yeah, and I think at that point, it's going to have gained some legitimacy, and you're going to see more than just, you know, hipster coffee shops who are going to be accepting it as actual payment.
So, well, I'm not talking about, they're talking about the futures. I'm talking about just throwing a little bit in there, because if it skyrockets just out of interest, pure interest, I mean, you know, if you put $100 in there, and the thing is worth twice that tomorrow, and you want to pull it back out, you just made $100. So, you know, I would throw a little bit in there and just not worry about it until this stuff starts showing up in the futures. And if the value of it goes way, way up during the frenzy of people selling off their, you know, when you have all these exchange people start, you know, buying up Bitcoin because they want to trade in it, that's when you sell yours off, because you might be able to turn $100 into $1,000. I mean, hell, if you bought Bitcoin at the right time, you could have.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, not a financier, not a actual accounting advice. What's legal, Madman? You know this shit. What's the actual legal thing I'm supposed to say so I don't get sued?
I'm not giving you sound financial advice. I am not a certified public accountant.
I am not an expert.
I'm currently consulting a cat to give you this information.
So, yeah. And
if it's on the futures exchange, that is not going to get it anywhere near you actually using it as money.
Oh, no, no. I'm not talking about using it as money. I'm talking about it getting traded as a commodity.
Okay. So, yeah, the only place that you'll actually be able to use it to buy something will still be hipster coffee shops.
God damn it.
And possibly a pot dealer.
If they're trendy enough and have a smartphone.
Why would I want to buy gardening supplies with Bitcoin?
Never know when you need to start planting tomatoes, my friend.
That is true. True.
So, yeah, Cycross is right. It's way too slow for most transactions. Oh, damn, he made a couple of grand with it. Nice! Yeah, if I'd been a little bit more disciplined about leaving it in there, I probably would have made quite a bit of money. But one, a lot of the early exchanges look squirrely as hell, and it's like, I'm not actually putting real money into this.
They
were squirrely as hell. Yeah. There wasn't a look to it.
Yeah, it was like they were sketchy.
It's like you took one look at this and said, nope. So,
everyone has heard of Mt. Gox. That's an early exchange. That was a credible early exchange.
And it was named after Magic the Gathering, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm putting that credible in quotes. I have to say that since this is a podcast.
Do you know why it was named after Magic the Gathering?
Was it a Magic exchange.
Yeah, wasn't it originally for trading cards? So.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Cycross is saying hold on to it yourself. Absolutely true. You can absolutely spin up your own wallet and do that. No, it was actually getting the Bitcoins in the first place. That's why I was playing around with the miner, because it's like, I don't want to give these people actual money. I don't even want to give these people like a green pack.
Yeah.
So. Anyways. Next up is a story from the Guardian. Anybody who's been paying attention, this is fairly obvious. More than 3 in 4, so, 3/4, Android apps contain at least one third-party tracker, according to a new analysis of hundreds of apps. The study by French research organization Exodus Privacy and Yale University's Privacy Lab analyzed the mobile apps for signatures of 25 known trackers, which use various techniques to glean personal information about users to better target them for advertising and services. Because nobody on the internet knows how to do anything else other than to targeted advertising. Among the apps found to be using some sort of the tracking plugin were some of the most popular apps in the Google Play Store, including Tinder, Spotify, Uber, and OkCupid. All four apps use a service owned by Google called Crashalytics that primarily track app crash reports. Okay, so these people may have done their study a little overly broad. But it can also provide the ability to get insight into your users, what they're doing, and inject live social content to delight them. In other words, ads.
So, sorry, I had a big old mouthful of stout there, which now, some of that is now leaking through my blood-brain barrier.
Sorry.
So, you mean someone is injecting things into my Tinder to do what now?
Now, if it's delight me, I want to see a bunch of cats swimming through petrol. And then hopping out the other side near a bunch of smokers.
Oh. Other less widely used trackers can often go much further. One is cited by Yale is FIDZUP, FIDZUP, a French tracking provider with technology that can detect the presence of mobile phones and therefore their owners using ultrasonic tones. FIDZUP says it no longer uses that technology. However, since tracking users through simple Wi-Fi networks works just as well. So they invented this crazy sonar thing using the tones of the listening for like ultrasonic tones, and then they figure out, oh yeah, Wi-Fi, we'll just use that. The Yale researchers said FIDZUP's practices closely resemble that of Temo, formerly known as Databerries. Well, I understand why they renamed their company Databerries. The tracker company that was embroiled in scandal earlier this year for studying the geolocation of 10 million French citizens and Safegraph, who collected 17 TN 17 TN location markers for 10 million smartphones. I guess it must be 17 trillion. For 10 million smartphones during Thanksgiving of last year. Both of these trackers have been profiled by privacy labs and can be identified by Exodus scans. Yale Privacy Lab is using its research to call on developers as well as Google for increased transparency into privacy and security practices as it relates to these trackers. The researchers added Android users and users of all app stores deserve a trusted train of software development, distribution, and installation that does not include unknown or masked third-party code. So scholars, privacy advocates, blah, 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 blah. Yale did not examine iOS. The company warns that the situation is probably no better.
That can't be trillion. You know how many call-outs those phones would have to make to hit 17 trillion?
Out of 10 million phones? It's not as many as you think.
Yeah.
A few billion.
But, yeah, but I mean...
A few hundred billion. I'm wrong.
If you think about it...
If they're pinging every couple of seconds, dude, that's not unlikely.
Well, and so, like, Bluetooth LE. Let's take this. Bluetooth LE, the reason why it's low energy is because it only pings out looking for other objects a quarter of the amount of time as standard Bluetooth. Okay? It still does it 4 times a second. So, I mean, network stuff travels and does things on a level that we just still can't comprehend.
Yeah, there's comprehension speed and then there's computer speed.
Yeah.
And I know when I'm writing scripts to do shit, I usually don't really think about how quickly these things are actually going to be running. So, you know, it's one of those things where it's like you run a script that you think, you know, because it took you an hour to think of how it's going to work, that you think it's going to take 10 to 15 minutes to run, and it's done in like a second. Like, oh, shit. So, yeah, CPU speed is not the same thing. And, you know, doing something a couple of hundred times a second is not weird for a modern smartphone.
Yeah. And it's not even considered, like, taxing it either. Like, that's standard.
Yeah.
100 times a second. I mean, that's...
So, final ones from Wired. Yeah, again, anybody who's been following smartphones for a while knows that these things are basically tracking devices.
Yeah, well, and so the thing that I like about the newest version of Android, actually, I don't even know if it's the newest one, is I can now tell it no on individual permissions.
Yeah, like, you can.
Like, go through and check what app is using what and turn off fucking permissions.
See, what version am I on? I'm on... Because I've seen that on my phone, too. What am I on? I'm on 8.5? No, that's the Samsung. 7.1.1.
I don't even know what I'm on. It just updated yesterday.
I just went to about... Like, I didn't know what version I was. I knew it was Android 7. I just didn't know which point version.
What am I on? Let's see.
That with a custom ROM, probably, I don't even know how long ago.
Yeah, years ago. You're right. I loaded CyanogenMod on an S3, and it had that kind of thing on it. You're right.
Yeah, I used a black phone for a while that did the same thing years ago. Yeah, 7.1.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, the question is more, do you know to go turn the shit off?
Yeah.
So, and the final news story I have for tonight is from Wired. Facebook may soon ask you to upload a photo of yourself that clearly shows your face to prove you're not a bot. The company is using a new type of CAPTCHA to verify whether a user is a real person. According to a screenshot of the identity test shared on Twitter on Tuesday and verified by Facebook, the prompt says, please upload a photo of yourself that clearly shows your face. We'll check it and then permanently delete it from our servers. Bullshit. In a statement to Wired, a Facebook spokesperson said that the photo test is intended to help us catch suspicious activity at various points of interaction on the site, including creating an account, sending friend requests, setting up ad payments, and creating or editing ads. The process is automated, including identifying a suspicious activity and checking the photo. To determine if the account is authentic, Facebook looks at whether the photo is unique. The Facebook spokesperson said the photo test is one of several methods, both automated and manual, used to detect suspicious activity. The company declined to share details to prevent the system from being manipulated. Suspicious activity might include someone who can constantly post photos from New York and then starts posting from Russia. The facial technology is increasingly common, such as use of Apple Face ID and authenticate users on iPhone X. Since a deleted screenshot from Twitter seemed to indicate that users are locked out of their account while the photo is being verified, a message said you can't log in right now. We'll get in touch with you after we've reviewed your photo. You'll be logged out of Facebook as a security precaution. Facebook users who suspect their account has been compromised can go to facebook.com/hack, blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's an improvement. At least now they're not telling you to send nudes.
I would rather do that.
You missed it a couple of weeks ago. They were saying we can help with revenge porn, send nudes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, I think they must have bought some crazy good, like, shape recognition image processing technology, and now they're just finding as many ways to use it as they can.
Or someone's like, I just want all of the nudes.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's Facebook, so
yeah.
That would surprise nobody. But I don't know that I like this idea of upload a selfie of yourself to verify. I mean, how much longer before we get to the verification can?
Ugh.
I wonder how hard it would be to trick it.
Well, considering how many bots already use a photo of a hot chick, I don't think it would be that hard.
Yeah.
They're looking for unique pictures.
Well.
But I wonder what you'd have to do to make it unique.
I imagine you could just take Photoshop and, like, cut the face out of the background and just put a different background on it, and that'd probably do it. If you were decent enough at Photoshop to do that without it looking really fake. Don't ask. In the IRC is saying if you were really good at 3D CG, you could probably make something that would sit there and generate unique pictures all day.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So... Yeah.
So what you need to do is you need to spin up your copy of Fallout 4 and just create a new character every time.
I like it. Well, actually, I heard an article earlier today. I didn't get it for decking. Where somebody had come up with an algorithm that would skew pixels on photos around the features that algorithms are using to identify faces, so that a person looking at it would still recognize who the photo was, but an algorithm could never figure it out because they had blurred, like, the crease lines on the nose and stuff like that, the parts that the algorithm is looking at to identify a unique face.
Okay.
Yeah, like corners of the mouth, you know, around the nostrils, eye corners, things like that. You know. Buzzing it enough to where you can still tell what it is, but the computer will never figure it out. So I wonder if something like that would work really well with this or not. Probably would. It'd probably throw it for a loop.
Remember a few years back, there were those people getting weird haircuts and wearing clothes to bypass facial recognition software?
We've had a couple of articles about people coming up with weird face paint that fucks with face recognition. So,
or just the ultraviolet lights in your hat.
Blast out the camera.
Friend has these shoes. Whenever someone takes a picture of him with a flash, it just F's the picture up completely.
Oh, because it's reflecting the infrared.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to this. Yo! All right, got a couple of things for Digital Dojo today. The first is this pretty handy little website called Two Factor Auth. Now, this is a little bit more of a basic site, but it's useful. So what it's doing is they're cataloging websites and whether or not they support multi-factor. Because, well, everybody knows that's pretty much the best way to keep your account from getting compromised, especially if you like using shitty passwords or reusing passwords. So... like, I'm just going to click on email. Here's a category. Apparently AOL mail, check mail, fast mail support it, Gmail supports, Hushmail supports. And then for everyone that doesn't support multi-factor, they've got a link. It's like, tell them to support two-factor auth on Twitter. Tell them to support two-factor auth on Facebook. And if they have an email contact form, they'll have an email button, which I just thought that was kind of fun. But the other really cool thing is they've actually got they're running it off of GitHub repo, and they accept pull requests, so you can actually add new sites to it and update it just by making requests. So, which also means the whole damn thing's on GitHub, so you could certainly pull their list and do things with it as well.
So, not that anyone would ever want to do anything with a list.
No. But you know,
and they're off.
You know, if you they have a link. So, you know, you go click here on, I don't know, EVE Online, and they've actually got a link to the part of the page that tells you how to set up an authenticator. So if you're dealing with family, say, over the holidays, and it's like, how do I not get my accounts hacked? You say, here, check this link. Find the stuff you use. Follow their instructions on the little docs link. And then go set up multi-factor on your phone for everything you care about.
So, you're way nicer than I am.
I am?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's like when my family comes to me and goes, hey, how do I not get hacked? I'm like, turn off your computers, walk away, live in a cave, fuck off. It doesn't. Privacy is, security is a lie and privacy is a myth.
Yeah.
That's usually what I tell them.
You're not wrong, but, you know, at least it's like, try. You know?
My family was kind of shitty, though.
All right, fine. This one will be more your speed than static. You sound like static syntax. You don't sound like static, but you're saying the same thing static would say. Well, so,
you know what? Maybe he's right.
So this one is a GitHub project called Caldera. Caldera is an automated adversary emulation system.
Oh, my God. This sounds amazing.
Is it red team? You hit the button and it plays red team.
Kind of. Caldera is an automated adversary emulation system that performs post-compromised adversarial behavior within enterprise networks. It generates plans during operations using a planning system and pre-configured adversary model based on the adversarial tactics, techniques, and common knowledge project.
It is persistence.
Yeah. These features allow Caldera to dynamically operate over a set of systems using variable behavior, which better represents how human adversaries perform operations than systems that follow a prescribed sequence of actions. Caldera is useful for defenders who want to generate real data that represents how an adversary would typically behave within their networks. Since Caldera's knowledge about how a network is gathered during its operation and is used to drive its use of techniques to reach a goal, defenders can get a glimpse of how the intrinsic security dependencies of their network and how allow an adversary to be prepared. It's threat modeling, okay? You drop this thing on the network. You say, this server got compromised. What does it do? And this thing actually goes through and simulates how it would attack your network. And, you know, you get the actual threat model that, you know, is based off these databases. But it's got an entire planning system that allows it to decide the next best action to take based on current knowledge of the environment. So it's actually sitting there like doing scans and figuring out what systems it can talk to and what's vulnerable and moving on to the next one, simulating how a real attacker would work. So if you're trying to defend your systems and you want to prove how to, you know, how a real adversary would move around in your network, this is for doing it. This is not a Nessus. This is not a Qualys or OpenVAS or any other scanner to tell you what's vulnerable. This is to tell you what happens after a system gets owned.
Yeah. Yeah, this is persistence emulation.
Yes, it is. It's still early days of it. It's still new. But yeah. this is going to get some use out of me.
Yeah. I may or may not be loading it or
downloading
it now.
So, you know, that this one's a little bit meaner than the last one. It's like, yeah, your system's fucked. Not only is it fucked, here's an attack path an actual attacker would use after they got into your system to steal your shit.
Mm-hmm.
Based on real world data and your network. So
this is amazing.
Oh, I really want to see this get better. And it's in Python, so it's like, you know.
Of course it's in Python, because it sounds like something that, like, an actual hacker would write.
Oh, I love Python. It just means that I can actually read the code and see what the hell it's actually doing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not, like, written in some weird-ass, you know, Lisp or something. So,
I ran into a guy, speaking of something weird, who was a consultant. He was a software consultant looking for jobs in my particular city. And I was like, so what's your favorite, you know, language that you like to program in? And he's like, Pascal.
Why? I'm like,
yeah, that was my... I was like, wait, what? Why? Does anyone actually still use that? And he's like, well, I do. And I'm like, oh. Well, that's one. I'm like, I didn't even know that there, like, it was still...
What do you compile that on? Well, I keep my AS400 over here just for...
Yeah, right? Fucking Pascal. You know what? That's what needs to happen. People need to start writing, you know, malware and stuff like that in, like, Pascal.
I don't know about Pascal, but if they used COBOL, you'd be surprised at how much they could fucking own, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And then when you have all of the forensics guys trying to, like, decompile it and figure it out.
You're sitting there looking at it. It's like, what is that written in? Perl 3. And they used all the shortcut characters. And it's all in one line. Son of a bitch.
Yeah. Like, don't use the latest technology. Go back a dozen generations.
Well, I mean, hell, it's probably pretty safe to run, like, Windows 98 on the internet today because nothing's attacking it. It's like, what? No 32-bit code. Get that shit out of here. I can't run that.
Yeah, I think I might have mentioned this, but there was a guy that took a...
You did, yeah.
Yeah, Windows 98 machine to DEF CON. And, like, yeah, it still got owned, but not nearly as much as he thought it did or thought it would. Like, that's amazing.
You know... If you went back to using an 8-bit computer.
Yeah. Or even, like, Windows 3.1.
You know, I could actually see seeing somebody doing some serious work on Windows 3.1. I just don't know what hardware you could run it on. Hell, I tried to... I pulled out my old netbook the other day. It's an Atom 1.6 megahertz, you know, bullshit computer. And it's like, what can I put on this to make it useful? I know. I'll go get that hacked release of DOS 7 and put that on there. And you know what? It kind of works, but it's like, this is useless. I thought I was going to turn it into a little gaming rig, but it's like, no, this just doesn't even. Useful.
I'm like, run it in a VM, but then you just have to have a base operating system. But
well, that's where you go get. Oh, damn. What's the Linux distro?
Yes.
It's using Xen under it, and they're doing multiple virtual machines to separate what you're doing. Cubes. Because I think Cubes got support for Windows not too long ago.
Awesome.
Yeah, I go Cubes. Windows.
Is it Cubes, or was it Hunix?
Hunix is if you're wanting to get on...
Tor.
Yeah, Tor, and not have a... And not have to worry about any kind of leakage because it's actually two virtual machines and one of them's playing router.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, Unix and Tails are kind of
actually the cool thing about Cubes actually supports Unix as a router because it's multiple virtual machines. So you can actually have multiple router machines and one of them can be Unix inside Cubes if you want to get on Tor and do shit. Installing Windows OS inside Cubes VM. Yeah, it is strongly suggested to enable auto login for Windows VMs that have the Cubes tools installed. Yeah, so they've got support for Windows 7 in Cubes. So you absolutely could, you know, load and run Windows apps separated by the Cubes OS.
Yeah, but we don't want to run Windows 7. We want to run Windows 3.1.
Well, if you can do Windows 7, you could probably not get. You probably won't get the tools to run, but you can probably run Windows 3.1. Why not? I mean.
Good point.
So, And then cubes just keeps it all segmented. But,
yeah, it keeps it all separated, yeah.
If you've never played with cubes, it's an amazing operating system. Kind of a pain in the ass to use, but... actually, Level 1 techs have a project going on in their forum right now to do headless hardware pass-through with KVM. So when they get that project done, if you can take their work and port it into cubes, you would probably have a damn near perfect system. Because you could run your Windows games utilizing a second video card in an isolated Windows VM that's segmented from the rest of your OS and still have all the separation that cubes gives you. Yeah. That would actually be a really fantastic way to operate. If you haven't seen the video syntax, if you just go look at Level 1 text, it was like the video they posted a couple of days ago where they're testing it. They're basically writing a frame buffer driver for Windows, and instead of hooking a monitor up to the video card that you pass through for your VM, they modified QMU, and then they have this frame buffer driver, so they basically they copy the memory out of the VM where it's drawing in the frame buffer, the screen, and because it's just simple CPU direct memory copy, just straight DMA from, you know, memory location 1 to 2, it's like, you know, less than a millisecond lag. And they were discovering that the lag in their testing rig was not created by the driver, but rather by the latency difference of the two monitors they were using.
That's amazing.
So it's just like, oh, they've got it solved. They just haven't opened. I went and read the thread earlier today because I'm sitting here just waiting for this to come out, because once this comes out, it's like, and we're going Linux full time.
Yeah,
I'll buy the second video card. It's fine. We're going Linux full time. Because at that point, we can keep Windows wrapped up in a virtual machine where it belongs. But
yes,
you know, as opposed to actually running hardware. But I've got some hardware stuff that actually requires Windows, and I like my games. So, but it's just. Yeah, that'll be awesome. You could combine that with cubes and just have a really nice setup as far as keeping things segmented. But anyways, I think that's all we got. So, yeah, I'll find you a link to that Level 1 thing. But they can't open source it yet because they've got a bunch of... the guy wrote the frame buffer driver against his own personal Windows key for driver signing. And they've already submitted it to Red Hat to get it included as part of the Vert.io tools.
Because
they're writing against KVM.
Okay.
So as soon as that gets updated and their patch to QMU gets, you know, out there, they can... They've also... We're talking about some other things that they pulled out of the VMware driver that has to get cleaned up because they can't open source that. Yeah, not VMware. NVIDIA. I'm sorry, NVIDIA. They're apparently writing it on Ryzen systems running NVIDIA graphics cards. But they've got some closed source code that they... put into this driver that they can't they can't publish it just yet. So as soon as they clean that up and get it published, I mean, because the moment that gets open sourced, the amount of patches and fixes and features coming into that is going to be amazing, because the number of people just waiting to make this, you know, the whole KVM pass-through thing cleaner.
Yeah, right.
Because it's like, there it is. They've got a working copy. They've got a functional prototype. They just got to, you know, clean it up and get it really to where they can release it. Because the moment that's dropped open source, that's going to be game over. I mean, it's going to be no reason to run Windows alone anymore. It's going to be, oh, you want to run Windows? Yeah, sure. Wrap that up in KVM, you'll be good to go. So,
Yeah. Wrap it up in KVM. Call it a day.
Yep. Anyways, that's all I've got. CyberLard, closing thoughts.
Seeing if I can gamify Caldera, make it like a video game.
Nice. Madman, closing thoughts.
Those phones were reporting on your location 20 times a second.
Yeah?
After I broke it down into 10 million different phones, it didn't seem...
Yeah, no, that doesn't even sound weird.
Yeah.
Especially with Android phones, because Android lets stuff run in the background. So you might have one app reporting 5 times a second, but if you're running, you know, 4 of them, there's your 20. And since they said it's 3 out of 4 apps doing that reporting, I mean, shit.
Turn your GPS off, kiddos.
Syntax, closing thoughts.
So today in future news, we know it's the end of times when DMX releases Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer cover song, which he has. Everyone go to YouTube now and look that up, because it's amazing.
Nice. All right. Of course, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Pure Decking every Thursday. Well, most every Thursday. We take breaks for when work shit happens and I can't do the show, or, you know, holidays, whatever. The Galaxy 15 radio site and the subreddit is probably the best way to get a hold of us. Of course, the IRC. In the IRC tonight, we had me, Sardonyx, Cyberlard, Cykros, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Iron Angel, Low Tech, and Syntax. Madman was also in there, but he literally quit out right before I read the list. Anyways, that's all I have for tonight. And I'm going to hit the Pac-Man sound now.